Some work I've done with a set of colleagues. You'll get citations along the way. And the basic tagline is quantum liquids and turbulent black holes. And I want to motivate to you the relationship between them and tell you about some of the physics we learn. So the take-home messages I want you to leave the room with are first that black hole horizons can have fractal-like properties. This is not a new idea, but the way that this is arising is a new idea. And secondly, that turbulence in two-dimensional superfluids can drive energy from the infrared from long distance to the UV to short distances. Both of these ideas may not be at all obvious as stated, but by the end, I hope they will. And I want these to be the take-homes. Now, along the way, we're going to get some important details and caveats on both claims. And so I'll explain those as they arise. And these are both from a pair of papers with my collaborators Paul Chesler and Hong Liu at MIT. Paul's now a postdoc at Harvard. And yeah, OK, so let me tell you about this. So the basic tool I'm going to use is holography. To many of you, this is a very familiar idea. So I just want to give you a very, very, very quick introduction in a minute. The basic tool is going to be a relationship between quantum fluids, quantum liquids, and some sort of classical gravity. So to tell you what I'm going to do to you, we're going to start with a quick introduction to holography for those of you who aren't super familiar. Then I want to tell you the story of the turbulent black holes we've studied and the turbulent superfluids we've studied. So to start with the intro to holography, for my purposes, holography today is going to mean a relationship between fluids and hydrodynamics and general relativity. This is a sort of baby version of holography or a restricted domain of holography. And it's a relationship between hydrodynamics and general relativity, where the hydrodynamics lives in two spatial dimensions and involves time evolution, and the general relativity lives in three plus time. Hydro starts with some equation like the fluid equation Navier-Stokes. And GR, on the GR side, we're going to solve the Einstein equations. In hydro, you introduce dissipation explicitly. In GR, something beautiful happens. It's Lagrangian theory with dissipation, where the dissipation is introduced by the appearance of horizons breaking time reversal invariance. And finally, we have strong interactions in classical limits. Now, you're not, if you haven't seen this before, this isn't going to explain anything to you. In a few slides, we'll come back to it, and hopefully you will understand what I'm saying. So, just to motivate the relationship, the horizon of a three-dimensional black hole is a two-dimensional surface. And I want to think about this two-dimensional surface as I deform it. So imagine I throw a rock at a black hole. Okay? As the rock approaches the black hole, well, we know from the equations of relativity that the rock is some source of stress and energy, and it deforms the space-time around it. And as it approaches the black hole, it deforms the space-time around the horizon, it deforms the horizon itself. Excitations just manifestly general relativistic excitations of the horizon as we throw in the rock spread along the horizon, and they spread in waves, and those waves spread and dissipate and fade, which is to say there's some irreversibility, things fall in and they don't fall out. So the horizon of a three-dimensional black hole in certain ways behaves like a two-dimensional liquid. Now I'd like to make that precise rather than jargon, or rather than slogan. So to make it precise, it's helpful to put things in a trap, which is what you'd normally do with a system you want to study. You put it in a box, and then you poke it and see how it responds. So what's a harmonic trap for gravity? Well, the answer to that is a very simple thing. It's a space-time with constant negative curvature. And why is that a good harmonic trap for gravity? Almost harmonic. Imagine you're sitting in the middle of some space with constant negative curvature, and you throw something, a rock again. So you throw your rock, and a beautiful thing about the space of constant negative curvature is that the object you throw always falls back to you in finite time, no matter how hard you throw it. So we give a name to this box. We call it Andy de Sitter space, after the well-known Dutch physicist Wilhelm Andy de Sitter. And we now have a box for gravity. And now what happens if we take our black hole that we want to poke and study, and we put it inside our gravitational box, put it in Andy de Sitter space? So here I have a fantastic artistic rendering of a black hole in my box. So in flat space and in ADS, black holes can radiate. In ADS, a black hole radiating, a la Hawking, sends its radiation out, but that radiation is like a rock earlier. It falls back in finite time. And so a strange thing happens with black holes in a box. They can come to equilibrium, true equilibrium with their Hawking radiation. So now we want to study that we've got a black hole in our box, that we can study it. It can be at thermodynamic equilibrium. We want to study it. We're going to study it by perturbing it. And the way we're going to perturb it is throw something in from far away, from the edge of the box, and see how the system responds. And by calculating the response given, or observing the response given any source, we can extract a green function or a two-point function. Holography is the idea that repeating this idea more broadly gives us a set of correlation functions on the boundary of our box, which is one lower dimensional than the bulk space, which by construction satisfy the consistency conditions of a quantum field theory, unitarity, locality, crossing, all these nice properties. The fact that that's true and can be done in a precise fashion is enormously non-trivial. But let me just tell you that that's the basic gig and that it does. Modulo technicalities basically does. So finally, if we take our field theory and we put it at finite temperature and finite density, well, quantum field theory at finite temperature and density, if you're lucky and things aren't insane, reduces to hydrodynamics, which is just the statement of conservation of energy and momentum. So what holography tells us then is that if we have a gravitational description, which is dual to the quantum field theory, if we put the quantum field theory at finite temperature and density, then the low energy physics of that, which should be the low energy physics of the black hole, is equivalent to the low energy physics of the field theory, which is hydrodynamics, on the boundary in one less dimension at the edge of our box. So this is the basic tool of holography for those who aren't super familiar already. Okay, and now, so coming back to this, it's a relationship between hydrodynamics, which is living on the boundary of our box, and general relativity with one fewer dimension in the hydro side, satisfying liquid equations, hydro, and satisfying the Einstein's equations. And again, a key tool for us, a key source of insight is going to be that dissipation is put into the system not by hand, but into a Lagrangian system where dissipation happens at a horizon. Okay, so with that, let me tell you about the work we did studying black holes dual to turbulence. So if our horizon behaves like a liquid, I should be able to stir that liquid and watch it form some sort of interesting turbulent dynamical flow. But following the holographic dictionary, this corresponds to solving the Einstein equations in the presence of some non-trivial initial conditions seeded by a little or seeded by enough noise to stimulate nonlinearities. So we'd like to see turbulence develop in our fluids by studying the gravitational side of the description. Yeah?
So you just said the fluid was somehow the field theory on the outer boundary, but then at the same time you're saying the horizon is the fluid, and I don't understand how you can conflate those two things.
Good. So that's a really good question. So here I'm conflating, I'm being very casual about my language. When I speak of the fluid, I'm really going to mean the dual fluid, which in some precise sense doesn't even live at the boundary. It's just an abstract dual theory. I'm going to colloquially, casually talk about it as the horizon. And you'll see why when I make it more precise. So later on, I'll make a much more precise statement about what's going on in the horizons, which are dual to the fluid fluid side of the equation. But you're absolutely right. The liquid I'm talking about is not the liquid at the horizon. I will sometimes talk about the horizon.
Can you anticipate how you get around the fact that the horizon has one null direction and all the rest are space-like? There's no... You can't causally influence anything besides your own generator.
Yeah, this is going to come up and play an important role for us a little bit later. So okay. I'm going to say something very simple right now and come back to that question later on when I talk about the horizon more precisely and its details. But for the moment, let me just say that I'm going to just imagine a neighborhood of the horizon, a stretched horizon, and worry about that briefly. But I'm going to give you precise statements later. Right now, I'm just giving you a heuristic. Yeah. It's a really good question, so please come back to it.
The classical... GR, when an observer falls through in proper time,
yes.
He sees nothing until
yes.
He gets to the singularity.
Yes.
How does this... on the other hand, you want a horizon with physical properties.
Good. So here all I'm going to ask about is the geometry of the neighborhood of the horizon. I'm not going to ask about an infaller. I'm only going to ask about the geometry seen by someone approaching arbitrarily close to the horizon. Yeah.
It takes an infinite amount of time to produce a horizon in gravitational collapse.
I'm not going to ask any questions about infall, and I'm not going to ask any questions about generation. I'm just going to ask questions about, you'll see exactly which questions I'm going to calculate. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm not going to be able to say anything about the internal structure infall. And I'm just going to avoid that entirely. Okay, so let's go ahead and do this. Let's try to set up a situation where the holographic dual involves a fluid that, if we allowed it to evolve as a fluid, would set up a turbulent flow and see what happens if we instead use that as boundary conditions for the Einstein equations in asymptotically any sitter space. So just to give you a quick couple of words on turbulence. Turbulence is one of those things that's extraordinarily hard to define, but as many people like to say, it's something you recognize when you see it. The working definition I want to give you, I'm going to give you a quick heuristic working definition and then two desiderata that are technical, what I want to mean by turbulence. So effectively, I'm going to think of turbulence as an on-average homogeneous isotropic quasi-steady state of a fluid. So it's not an equilibrium system, but on average it's homogeneous, doesn't really matter where you look. On average it's isotropic, doesn't really matter in what direction you look, even though locally it isn't at any given moment in time or point in space. On top of that, there are a few things that we can really hold on to with turbulence. So in true driven turbulence, equilibrium, quasi-steady state turbulence, a very simple result comes from Kolmogorov. It's one of the very few things we can truly be confident about. And it's just dimensional analysis, and it says the following. Imagine that you've got some turbulent flow, and its total energy is dissipating at a particular rate, which means if it's quasi-steady state, you're also dumping in energy at a particular rate. Let's call that rate epsilon. So that's the dimensions of epsilon are determined just by the dimensions of energy and time. So you can then ask, how much energy, if we know nothing else, how much energy can be supported in wave number k? And the only other parameter available to you is k. So just doing some simple dimensional analysis, here non-relativistic, gives us that the energy density in wave number k should go as a constant times the energy dissipation rate to the 2/3 and k to the minus 5/3. You'll notice that this is just involving the dimensions of energy and time. So it doesn't, and k for that matter, so it doesn't depend on the number of spatial dimensions. It's a general statement. When you have such a quasi-equilibrium steady state, it should obtain. There's a more precise version, though, of Kolmogorov scaling. This is what's usually quoted. There's a more precise version, which is what I would really like. And let me just say right now, we haven't been able to build, but for reasons that are, I think, technical, not interesting. The more precise statement is that if you look at if you take the flow and you study its fluctuations, in particular, how it changes at 2 points separated by distance r, you average over those distance r and raise it to the nth power, or raise it to the nth power and then average. Then, again, from dimensional analysis, you get that this should go as a constant times, where n is here the number of powers of the velocity, the energy dissipation rate to the n upon 3, and the distance to the n upon 3. And in fact, from this, you can back out the energy scaling law. Okay. So this is an integer countable infinite set of correlators and of predicted scalings. And one of the really interesting questions in fluid dynamics, in turbulence, is not, you know, do you see Kolmogorov scaling? Because A, yes, roughly you do see Kolmogorov scaling, and you know, that's one number. But the really interesting question is, first off, if you look at real flows, or for that matter, good numerical flows, you don't get exactly Kolmogorov scaling. For the endpoint functions, you get smack on the Kolmogorov scaling for the three-point function, but for all other n, you don't. And you consistently, robustly don't get exactly Kolmogorov scaling. And and there are raging arguments about exactly why that is. And that's the thing I would really love to address, which I'm not going to be able to say anything about today. The reason I'm not going to be able to say anything about, just to say it quickly, is that we're going to be studying decaying turbulence rather than quasi-steady state driven turbulence. And there's technical reasons why that's an annoyingly hard thing to do. But if you're interested in this question, ask me about it afterwards. We will, however, see this crop up, and it's going to play an important role for us. Okay. So second thing about turbulence, apart from the Kolmogorov scaling, is that generally when you see a turbulent flow, what's going on is you have some scale, some range of scales. Here this is log k, log of the wave number, and log of the energy spectrum. You have some range of scales where there's a power law controlling the energy density per scale. And that usually goes from an infrared bound to a UV bound. And a basic question involving this this so-called cascade is whether the cascade is direct or inverse, i.e. whether the cascade is driving excitations to shorter and shorter structure, as when you pour milk into coffee and you get the beautiful filigree forming, or whether the short-distance physics that's injected into the system is driven to long distance where it forms coherent structures. For example, in the atmosphere, if you have excitations in the atmosphere larger than the thickness of that layer of the atmosphere, then over long timescales, those excitations will tend to merge together and form large-scale structure, which drive into coherent structures like hurricanes. So you get large-scale structure when you have an inverse cascade. And a classic result is that an observed result is that in two dimensions, you get an inverse cascade, you get hurricanes forming eventually, and in three or higher dimensions, you should get a direct cascade to the UV. So part of the reason for that involves what's called the entropy, which is an extra conserved quantity in ideal hydrodynamics. And this was studied in the context I'm going to talk about in a little bit by Carrasco, Lehner, Myers, Rula, and Singh. I'll come back to that in a bit. Okay, but this is my basic picture of turbulence, what it is, what I want, and what we'll be hunting for. So first question is going to be just the obvious question. If we have a turbulent fluid flow, do we get what does that tell you about the metric? So here what we're doing is we're taking, this is going to be a simulation, which we'll run in a second, where what we're doing is solving the Einstein equations in asymptotically ADS space, where initial conditions, roughly speaking, go like this. You can think of it either from the boundary or from the bulk. From the boundary point of view, it's going to be a series of flows of the fluid from the dual fluid point of view, where you've got a stream of fluid going one way, stream of fluid going the other, fluid going one way, fluid going the other. In between those two fluids, you've got a gradient of the fluid, and that's going to give you some vorticity. So what you're seeing here is a plot of the vorticity, large vorticity, large negative vorticity, large vorticity, large negative vorticity. Okay? And the reason this is a good initial condition is because it sets you up for what's called a two-stream instability, where if you have two streams, if you have two streams going past each other, and there's a little bump in one, it's going to tend to impede the flow of the other, which is going to tend to impede the flow even further, and you're going to get a dramatic breakdown of that laminar flowing. So this is a good set of initial conditions, or an interesting set of initial conditions, to generate a turbulent flow quickly. Okay. Now we're going to solve this from in the bulk by solving the Einstein equations and see what we get. So what I'm going to plot for you is the fluid flow, the dual fluid flow having, and the vorticity in particular, having solved the Einstein equations in the bulk. And I should say the numerical heavy lifting here is Paul, who was at the time Popolardo Fellow at MIT, and he's done some really nice work on this. So here's the flow. You see we seeded this with small inhomogeneities, and relatively rapidly, those inhomogeneities source an instability, which is basically a two-flow instability. And you see this break up to lots of little tiny bits and pieces. But relatively quickly, the little tiny bits and pieces start forming larger scale structures, and you start getting larger and larger domains where smaller and smaller bits come together and form larger and larger domains. So just to give you a sense for how that compares to a fluid flow, here's an example. It's a fluid flow. I'll come back to what exactly I'm doing in the fluid calculation. But here's an example studying the appropriate dual fluid equations with essentially similar initial conditions. The only thing that changed here was the size of the box and the details of the initial random inhomogeneities. But it's otherwise the same dynamics. Also, just to warn you, the sampling rate was different. So this is going to look like it's going faster, but it's the same dynamics. So again, you see it breaking up into a tremendous number of small inhomogeneities, which form larger scale structure very rapidly, qualitatively very, very similar to what we got from the numerical relativity. So just to give you a picture, so here's a picture of the horizon area density. And here I'm just taking the metric, chopping, and looking at the horizon area, the local picture of the horizon area density. And again, you see that this generates all sorts of complicated roiling dynamics, but that eventually you see relatively fewer small-scale features and relatively few large-scale structures dominating. So let's look at the spectrum of that. So here in blue, ignore the green for the moment, in blue is the power spectrum as a function of time and wave number k. And the first thing I want to call your attention to is, so here it is at time 848 in units where temperature is pi, inverse 2/3 pi, or 1, depending on how you want to normalize things. And the time is considerably later here. This is basically after the initial transients have all dissolved away. And here we have a later time in the evolution. So again, let's focus on the blue, which is the kinetic energy power spectrum in the fluid. And there's a little domain. And this red line, I should say, is minus 5/3. So if you squint, you might be tempted to look at this and say, aha, it looks like there's a short regime over which it's scaling here, then it sort of descends away. And here it looks like it's scaling over a slightly larger regime, but there are a bunch of things you should say that caution that interpretation a little too quickly. The first is notice the domain here. So this is over less than a decade of wave number, so it's not exactly super robust. And the second is exactly where you cut that off is not super obvious, right? So you could have tilted that red line. That red line is mostly guidance for the eye. So at this point, I wouldn't call this something that I would, bet Martin Rees's dog over. On the other hand, we can ask, why is that the case? So the basic constraint for us is that we only had so much time and calculational power. So we had an IR cutoff in the system because our box was only so big. And we had a microscopic cutoff in the system because it's at finite temperature. So we're bumping up against those bounds. So for reasons that I'll come back to in a second, I expect with some real confidence that if we extended this, you'd see a much larger range of scaling. The more important thing to me is this green line. So this green line is the horizon curvature power spectrum divided by k squared. And a priori, these are two totally different quantities. How much curvature is there in the horizon in wave number k, supported in wave number k, versus what's the power spectrum of the dual fluid flow? And as was pointed out earlier, these are, even if you want to think about the horizon as itself defining a fluid, these are different fluids with different properties, and they mean different things. They occupy a different logical place in the theory. So they really don't need to be the same thing on the face of it. And they're not the same thing. They certainly don't need to have similar properties amongst their power spectrum on the face of it. However, you can see from the numerics that it's pretty clear that they track each other very closely. And not only initially, they continue to track each other. And in every simulation we did, they track each other very, very tightly. So now we can go back to the holographic equations, to the fluid gravity equations, and ask why that's the case. And it turns, so let me just say that for the moment, this is a numerical observation. So we can go back to the fluid gravity equations and discover that this isn't just an approximation, a coincidence of the numerics, but we can actually derive this in the regime where fluid gravity duality is a good description. So this is actually a precise relation with corrections suppressed by the powers of the gradients in the fluid. Literally in the hydrodynamic expansion, the subleading corrections to this are hydrodynamic in nature. Okay, so that's cool. But interestingly, if you take the k to the minus 5/3 law, so now imagine we didn't have the limitations of our computer, and we actually took a fluid that had full Kolmogorov scaling over some huge domain. In that case, p should go like k to the minus 5/3 over a large domain. But plugging this in tells us that the area curvature spectrum goes like k to the 1/3 over a large domain. And that tells us, because the curvature is controlling the rate of growth of the area in a very precise and simple way, that tells us that the area of the horizon is changing in time in a way that depends on the power spectrum of the fluid. And plugging this in, this goes like k to the 1/3 integral dk. But that means it's a UV divergent integral. So if you imagine doing this integral with a cutoff, the area should grow as that cutoff to the 4/3. So far I haven't swindled you. Now when you look at this, this should set off some alarms. And not alarms like, you know, totally insane, but alarms in the following sense. Imagine I told you I had a line stretching from here to here with some complicated curvy structure. And if you measure it with a yardstick, you get about a meter. Great. Or a yard, I guess, if you measure it with a yardstick. So then I tell you that, look, okay, if you measure it with a 1-inch ruler, you'll discover that it's actually a curved curve, and it's longer than 1 yard. And you measure it with a finer little small measuring device, and you'll find that it has smaller features. Now, eventually, it's just a line, right? So eventually, as you measure with shorter and shorter things, you'll discover that it's effectively straight on that scale, and you'll converge to the actual length of that line. So In the expansion, in cutoff in spatial distance, 1 upon k, you should converge as you go to short distances or high effective momenta cutoff. Here, it's diverging. So what does that mean? Well, imagine you had this line, and it was diverging as you went to short and short length scales. That should make you think of, you know, the coast of Norway, right? It's a fractal. Well, let's try to make that a little more precise. So here's something that I can say with great confidence. If we have a fluid system which has a Kolmogorov scaling over a large domain, then over that domain, the curvature spectrum of the dual horizon scales is k to the 4/3. And if you calculate the change in area in time, say over 1 second, that quantity will strictly diverge as you go to the UV cutoff. It will diverge with the UV cutoff. Okay. It's the temptation at the next stage is to do exactly what I just did and interpret the momentum cutoff as a link scale cutoff, as a UV link scale cutoff, and get that the area is expanding as a fractal would if the fractal had dimension d, which in this case is 2, plus 4/3. So note that none of this involved the numerics. This all involved a numerical observation that you can derive analytically in the fluid, in the regime where the fluid gravity dictionary is reliable, and then following the logic. Okay. Now, at this point, I want to send out a couple of notes of caution. So the first note of caution is this. So the argument that goes from the Fourier expansion, the curvature spectrum supported wave number k, to the box counting requires some real, I mean, it's a technically delicate thing you have to do carefully, and so it's you know, I wouldn't stake my life on it at this point. I think it's probably right or some close to right. But here's the reason I'm hedging a little bit. is that this is 4/3, which is greater than 1. In particular, if you have a two-dimensional black hole horizon, then it would say that the horizon, that's if it's dual to a turbulent flow, should have fractal dimension 3 1/3. But that's really weird because the ambient space is only 3 spatial dimensional. And how do you shove a 3 1/3 dimensional surface into a 3-dimensional space? And so that embedding problem is, you know, a simple one, and you can't do it. So at least not in any simple, familiar way that I know of. So there's something confusing going on. There's a basic tension at play, and I'm not sure at this point what the technical out is. But I want to advertise that as something that we're confused about. And yeah. We have, but since we're using a characteristic method, we'd expect it to die horribly if there were caustics form. So I don't think that's the problem. Tell me if this is equivalent to what you're thinking, slightly, you know, revisioned. One concern I had is maybe the surface just isn't embeddable in three spatial dimensions, right? It's some complicated intersection of null surfaces. Maybe it's not embeddable. That doesn't feel right to me, but you know. Fixed time, it should just be but I'm not sure. I don't think it's because there are caustics outside the horizon, but it may be because the Frobenius relations are being violated because of some complicated curviness, fluctuationness of the horizon. Did that go some way to answering your question, or at least sharing my confusion about it?
It raised a different point than I was thinking. Maybe we can talk later.
I'd like that. Thanks. Yeah.
You will have stochastic dissipation. This turbulence is dissipation.
Yes.
Which will dissipate caustics.
It will certainly dissipate. Yeah. It's not clear to me that something is guaranteeing that caustics will never form outside the horizon, though.
Also, people identify the area with entropy.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So this,
you have entropy varying with time.
Yeah, yeah.
Now you're saying entropy is fractal.
Well, I'm not quite saying that entropy is fractal. I'll make a more precise statement than that. Here's a statement I'll make. The area element controls the entropy current on the horizon. Okay? As you're saying, there's a relationship between the total area and the total entropy of the system. So from these relations, we should be able to answer the question, how rapidly is the entropy of the system growing? And it's growing, at least its spectrum, is growing as the cutoff to the 4/3. This is a known fact in fluid dynamics. In fact, you can derive it from the Kolmogorov scaling, that the entropy density diverges in this fashion.
So you don't violate the second law.
I don't think we're violating the second law. It has
to increase.
Sorry?
Entropy always increases.
The entropy is increasing. The sign is correct.
So how do you know it's increasing?
Well, the sign. So you can just look at the sign of this beast and it's positive.
So it never decreases.
No, it never decreases. I don't know how to derive a quick spectral theorem, but it'll give me 10 minutes. There's a, you know, it's a spectral density. It's going to be positive. It's an irreversible process. And
it has to increase.
And this is because stuff falls in and it does not come out at the end of the day. Okay, you're absolutely right. And so that actually was one of the points that made me feel more comfortable with this observation about the growth of the area, because it actually fits with a known fact that we weren't paying attention to. So that was very reassuring. Also say that, well, ask me afterwards about the positivity question. There's more to say, but I don't want to take the time right now. Did that answer your question for the moment, though? Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question for the moment?
Wonderful.
Okay, good. Rob.
I mean, this scaling comes for some process that you haven't studied yet. So what, I mean, you have to have some kind of driven system, no? So what?
Yeah.
What kind of process are we really talking about?
Excellent question. So everything I've been talking about is decaying of initial excited states, not quasi-steady state turbulence. Okay. So let me say two things about that. The first is why, and the second is addressing your question of how does the story change and what's the physics of that. So first, the why. And the why is, it turns out, first off, these calculations take a little bit of time. They're a little, you know, they're not like super complicated. In the space of numerical relativity, they're really quite simple and you know, childish even. But they still are time intensive. So one consequence of that is that tweaking initial conditions is a little bit, you know, it's involved. Here's what we kept finding. When we drive the system, when we drive it just a, you know, gently, some controlled spectrum, some simple way, almost always what we find is that we drive the system either too hard and drive it white dynamically, non-linearly, out of the regime of validity of the fluid gravity correspondence, or we don't drive it enough to do anything. And there's a tuning problem there, and I don't know why this turns out to be in practice difficult. My guess is that we're probably thinking about something a little bit wrong. But pragmatically, when we've tried to drive the system, it just turns out to be difficult to drive it gently, but not trivially. So that's a stupidity, I think, of the analysis. And I'm sure that's a solvable problem, and it's something I would like to solve.
Could it be trying to tell you something?
I don't think so, for the following reason. If you look at the fluid gravity equations, the consistency of the fluid gravity expansion is controlled by the gradient expansion. So we can have a turbulent flow in a fluid, in hydrodynamics, where there's orders of magnitude along the inertial regime, where you've got many decades in the inertial regime, all of which is well inside hydro. And if it's well inside hydro, that tells me it's well inside fluid gravity, which in particular means that it's not generating caustics that are killing itself, that's killing the approximation. It's still a tubular system. So I don't think there's any in principle reason. Now, I could be wrong about that, but every bit of effective field theory type argument that asking what are the boundaries of convergence says that this should work.
So just ready to comment. So I have a student, Wester Nacker Schneider John, who's working precisely about this question on the hydro side.
Yes.
And so you could ask the same question there. And one particular issue that you have to deal with is the fact that you have put things in a periodic box. So if you that finite size is actually allowing for a condensate to take place, would actually mess things up. So you can address that. And as he's done that, and then you get the minus five thirds actually pretty cleanly. And so he's driving it at a given frequency, and you see the minus five thirds towards long wavelength and minus three to short wavelength. So,
by working in an open box?
No, he has a box, but then the standard way of attacking this on the hydro side is to introduce some viscosity, some extra long wavelength.
Some extra long wavelength quarter term. Yeah,
so that
exactly.
You don't keep accumulating energy and don't form condensate.
Right. This is probably best discussed afterwards, but let me just say a couple of quick thoughts on that. One thing I really don't want to do if I don't absolutely have to is muck with the bulk gravity equations. Because if at the end of the day I want to be making an argument about the physics of the boundary fluid, which is, as you'll see in the next go around, what I want to be making, then I really don't want to be messing with the Einstein equations. I want to just be trusting them.
Sure. So in that case, when you do something that's equivalent, then you just take your signal.
Yes.
Take out the coherent part and then just analyze the incoherent part. And if you do that, then again you get the minus five thirds.
There I believe that you get the minus five thirds. I just don't know about
I don't know how much I should be trusting the long time dynamics if I'm filtering out the long wavelength modes, which I'd think of as changing the physics as well. But I mean this is exactly the kind of question that I want to understand. So yeah.
So in your simulation, are you driving at the exact same max?
No, we're not driving. So here we input,
what we did is we input energy by starting in an excited state, and that excited state had most of its energy over a longer wavelength, over a short wavelength, which is longer than inverse K max, but shorter than the size of the box. So we have a box size, we have the initial injection size, and then we have the microscopic cutoff size K max. So we can resolve all those scales. We're not driving the system, though. We put in an initial pulse of energy.
Yeah, I saw the cascade towards shorter wavelengths follows a different power law.
Yeah, no. They follow the same power law.
It's also 5-star?
Oh, sorry. Let me go back to this. So do you mean this region?
Yeah,
that's not a cascade.
So more precisely, you can understand that in terms of microphysics. It's not about the long-distance hydrodynamical behavior of the system. It's about short distance physics in the fluid. So if you will, you can think of this as a chemical potential scale that's telling you where there's a microscopic effects come in and become important. Dissipation is kicking in there because of the microphysics. So it ceases to be well described by hydro.
Yeah, it's dispersed, but the initial conditions are around here.
Okay. But I mean, they have support over a large region. They're not localized. It's not a delta function source. Okay. So, So the point here is that black hole horizons can have fractal-like properties, and making that precise is something that remains confusing to us, in particular interpreting this in terms of a precise fractal dimension. Let me just say, though, that whatever else, however one is correctly to interpret the four thirds, either as some calculational mistake we made, or as in the box counting procedure, or in terms of some interesting fact about caustics or a failure of the Frobenius relation, so it's not embeddable, or something like that. Whatever else is true of that, the analytic discussion up until the calculation of the fractal dimension shows you that the area diverges, right? So as you drive the cutoff shorter and shorter, the area diverges. So that is what I normally mean by a fractal, right? So so that's why I say here fractal-like properties, but I'm not going to quite jump off a cliff and say exactly the fractal dimension of Diophantine.
Entropy divergence.
Sorry?
If you identify the area with entropy.
Yes.
Then the entropy is
yes, diverged. Absolutely. Then the entropy would diverge.
And then it becomes, when you ask about the physical system, it becomes very important to realize that there's a microscopic scale where the scaling ceases, where dissipation becomes strong and you exit the hydrodynamic regime. So that's absolutely right. The entropy would diverge were it not for the physical cutoff of the microphysics.
You would expect the dissipation to smear out the divergence.
Yes, exactly. We don't see any divergence. That's correct.
So it wouldn't diverge.
No, it becomes finite because at that scale, right, exactly. OK, I was going to give you a short aside that ties into some work of Luis's and collaborators. Let me skip all this. So instead of solving the Einstein equation, something that you could just as reasonably do is solve the hydro equation and plug into the analytic expression for the fluid gravity metric and see what you get. So your job in this, from this point of view, is to solve the conservation equations of hydrodynamics as well as you possibly can numerically, and then to deduce something about the gravitational solution. So Carrasco, Lehner, Myers, Rula, and Singh did a very lovely job of this with a leading order metric. I also gave this problem to a couple of undergrads as sort of a lark of a problem, and they did a really nice job of it, actually, very quickly. So what I told them to do is to solve second-order dissipative relativistic hydro on their laptops, and they did. And they did a pretty damn good job, actually, over the course of a summer. I told them to plug into, so so these equations appear in a paper by Mark van Ramsdonk, and they're awesome. It's the fluid gravity metric that you get. If you know what the fluid velocity is, you could solve in perturbation theory the Einstein equations to get the full metric at any order in the hydrodynamic expansion you want. It's a closed form expression. So I said, OK, great. Take this, plug in, calculate the metric, and see what you get. Does it work? So they calculated, first they found solutions, and then they went through and they plugged in their results into the first and second order, the zeroth first and second order expansion for the metric in the hydrodynamic expansion. And what they got was at first order, it worked beautifully. So zeroth and first order, it worked beautifully. But when we did the second order metric, it exploded in your faces. Things diverged, all sorts of horrible things happened, and this was very upsetting and confusing. But again, it was two undergrads, so you know, maybe not so shocking. But they're pretty good undergrads. And so what they did is, one undergrad had put in his senior thesis this little dinosaur comic. For anyone who knows the dinosaur comics, this is dear to my heart. I'm sure it'll work out. Maybe your fluid gravity theory is wrong. What? Please, it's way too awesome to be false. And I feel like I've really taught him something if he wrote this in his thesis. So these two guys, Nathan and Wojtek, Nathan's now a grad student at Stanford and Wojtek's at Berkeley, after, you know, bug killing in their code, we just rederived the equations. And it was just really a simple thing. There were a couple of simple typos in the equations in Mark's paper. And we emailed Mark and said, you know, hey, what's up? And he's like, yeah, those are typos. So that was useful and taught them a lot of physics. And so then we went in and plugged in. And for the first few runs, this worked absolutely gorgeous. So what we're doing here is we're calculating the norm of the Einstein tensor integrated. It's not covariant, but you know, I don't care. It's just a number I can compute that should vanish. And integrated over the volume of the calculation. Blue is the boosted black brain of the zeroth order. Green is red is the first order, and green is the second order correction. So this is the failure to solve the Einstein equations integrated over the whole space. So the fact we've integrated over a large volume of like side like 1,000 tells you that we're doing a pretty good job if these are still small numbers. So this is something like part in 10 to the 5 or 6 accuracy in solving for the first order metric. But here's the funny thing. The first order and second order are very, very close to each other. So, and that kept happening. So then we really cranked up the amplitude of the fluid flow. And now things got really bewildering. So blue is the zeroth order. Red is the first order, and they have a nice separation between them. And here's the second order corrections. Those should be small. And they're really not. So what's going on here? So there are a couple of answers to this question. I'm not sure what
the complete answer to the question is, but I have a student right now who, for his undergraduate thesis, I should say, this should have been put out like a year and a half ago, but they graduated, we got confused, and it just languished. So now undergrad number three is working on the what's going on here. And there are a couple of things that are going on. One is some details about exactly how we did the calculation of the fluid gravity metric in the bulk, and it's sort of numerical and stupid. But a second involves how we'd calculated the fluid equations on the boundary and really unpleasant interplays between numerical errors. So I think at this point what's really going on here is that this is some numerical errors that were from a bad treatment of some derivatives, of some gradients. And so he is rewriting that to hopefully address the problem. I'm a little bit bewildered by this. Analytically, it works out beautifully, but somewhere in the numerics, things are going wild. And which, you know, anyone who does numerics for a living will understand that this is one of the worst things that can happen, where you really know how it should work, and some silly thing is just killing you, and you go through every line of code. So there's no small part of my soul has been torn open with this. Anyway, it'll make a great senior thesis if they figure it out. So moving on now from the terminal black holes, I want to tell you about our work with superfluids. So what we just did was use turbulence in a fluid to study the physics of black holes. I'd like to turn that around and use things we know about black holes that we love and hold dear to learn something about a fluid that I don't know something about, so there's an open question. And in particular, I'm going to be interested in quantum turbulence or turbulence in superfluids. So here's a long-standing question, and it's sort of bizarre that it's long-standing. Do 2D superfluids exhibit a direct or an indirect cascade? Okay. So it's known for normal fluids. In normal fluids, you have an inverse cascade. You get large-scale structure and coherent structures and hurricanes. In 3D, you get a direct cascade. You flow to short distance, filigree. What about in a superfluid? Well, the argument for this, the analytic argument for the inverse cascade, which goes back to a totally nutso guy named Krychnan, who's just amazingly interesting. I haven't found a good biography, but there's there must somewhere be a just breathtaking biography of this guy. The argument for the inverse cascade in the atmosphere, which took a surprisingly long time to nail down experimentally, goes back to this idea of a conserved entropy. So energy density, roughly speaking, is the square of the velocity. Entropy is the square of the vorticity. Now, the vorticity is a conserved quantity in, the entropy is a conserved quantity in two-dimensional fluids. And the reason this gives you large, wow, I wish I'd written that. The reason this gives you large-scale structure, I guess I'll do this over here. The reason this gives you large-scale structure is if you have something like vorticity that's conserved, then this could be positive or negative. But if this squared integrated is conserved, so this is the entropy, the square of the vorticity, then imagine you have a hurricane and an anti-hurricane, or rather just a rotating bit and an anti-rotating bit in your fluid. It's tempting as microphysicist to look at these and say, aha, this is winding number one, this is winding number minus one, they annihilate and you get dust. But in fact, this carries some vorticity, let's say one, and this carries some vorticity, let's say minus one. But that's entropy one and entropy one. So the total entropy is two. These guys cannot annihilate. So what you get is you get stuff forming larger structures and smaller structures. You get really complicated interplay. So this was the observation of Krychnan and the explanation for the inverse scattering in, or for the inverse cascade in a 2D normal fluid. Now, in a superfluid, the story is completely and utterly different. And the reason is really simple. In a superfluid, what you have instead of, you know, hurricanes is you have quantized vortices. And these guys really do have winding number plus one and winding number minus one. And they really can annihilate, right? There's no analog of the conserved entropy. This is a quirk of the non-relativistic ideal hydro equations that this is a conserved quantity in 2D. It's not only is it not true, it doesn't even make sense to ask the question in a superfluid, where at the core of the vortex, the velocity field doesn't even make sense, because the phase is ill-defined, and if the velocity is the gradient of the phase, then the velocity itself is ill-defined. So you can't use this kind of reasoning to argue that the cascade should be direct or inverse. Okay? So that leaves the question open. Now, on the other hand, away from the core of the vortices, superfluid hydrodynamics looks an awful lot like normal fluid hydrodynamics. So if you just sort of squinted anytime you saw a vortex, it wouldn't shock you too much if the basic same long scale dynamics played out. Okay? So it's an interesting question, do 2D superfluids, clean 2D superfluids, generate an inverse or a direct cascade, or just no cascade at all. So people have done various experiments, but they're all very hard. There's a whole complicated story with counterflow experiments. People have also done numerical simulations, but in the numerical simulations, here's the problem. In numerical simulations, at the end of the day, you have to pick some microphysics to describe the core of the vortex. But this is really some quantum field theory, and you're getting back to the, you know, the true origin non-symmetry breaking ground state in the core. So it's really microphysics that controls how these guys interact, especially as the cores get close. So in order to do in order to really answer the question, you need to know exactly what the microphysics is, and then you need to solve it exactly. But that's a quantum field theory, and that's hard. So that's one of the reasons. So that's the question. Longstanding question is: do 2D superfluids exhibit direct or indirect cascades? So for me, if I want to answer this holographically, the more direct question is, what's the holographic description of a superfluid? So I'm going to jump through this pretty quickly. The dual of a superfluid is basically the same as before. You take a black hole, you put it in a box, but now we add some charge. And that means instead of just the Einstein equations, we're solving the charged Maxwell scalar Einstein equations. You could have added all sorts of matter here. I'm going to add a scalar. You know, pick your dressing. So why does this correspond to a superfluid? Well, we have our black hole. It carries some charge, and charge, I guess, is conventionally yellow. And at low temperature, in ADS, in a box, well, at low temperature, black holes will expel some of their charge. There's only so much charge they can have as a function of mass. But if we're in a box, that charge can't get away. So in our anti-de Sitter box, the charge floats as a sort of quasi-stable halo around the black hole. It's expelled gravitationally, but it's repelled gravitationally also from the boundary. It can't get away. So why does this give us a superfluid? Well, the charged halo of the black hole is basically acting like a mirror. It's a bunch of charges. They're free to move around. If you send an electromagnetic pulse in, they'll respond by moving to cancel out that field. So if you send in a source and you scatter it out, it reflects off the charged condensate in the middle. What that means is it can't get to the black, to the horizon, which is where dissipation happens. Dissipation is localized here in this Lagrangian theory at the horizon. So these electromagnetic excitations can't reach the horizon to dissipate because they're screened, the horizon is screened by this charged halo. So that's what a holographic superfluid is. Now, one of the nice things about this is to the degree that this gravitational setup defines a quantum field theory and thus defines its low energy hydrodynamic limit, this just gives us a precise definition of the superfluid, which includes all the microphysics and all the macrophysics. Okay? So here's a place where I can actually study this question without any tinkering around with parameters, deciding what I want my vortex scattering cross sections to be. So now we can ask the question, at least in this system, I'm not making any claim to universality or anything, it's just in this system, what happens? Do we get a direct or an inverse cascade? So again, this is with Paul and Hong. And here's a simulation where we set up, it's sort of a moral analog to the one I showed you earlier. Here what we've got in our superfluid is we're looking at the vorticity again. We're looking at a regulated version of the vorticity. It's basically winding. So this is saying we've got a large number of vortices. And in fact, what we have is a lattice of 8 by 8 lattice of vortices, each of winding number 6 and minus 6, 6, minus 6, 6, minus 6. So this is a highly excited initial state. And so let's see what happens as we let it evolve. So the first thing you notice is that these winding number 6 excitations, vortices, break up into their winding number 1 cousins. The energy goes as n squared, so that's sort of energetically guaranteed. But then the vortices and anti-vortices from neighboring guys in the lattice find each other, annihilate, and have these little two-body annihilation events, sending big pulses of waves of excitation into the bulk of the system. So just to show you that again, so they decay, and these vortices and anti-vortices will start finding each other and pairing up or annihilating. And so in the intermediate regime, you get a very complicated quasi-static, isotropic, on-average homogeneous flow, which looks at, you know, again, turbulence is the thing that looks like turbulence. So is it, in fact, something that statistically looks turbulent? Oh, just for a fun thing to do, let me show you what that looks like in the bulk. So here's the boundary of our box, the boundary of our harmonic trap. And plotted here is a vorticity, winding number, effectively. In the bulk, here's an isosurface that, I speak in MATLAB now, here's a surface of constant charge density in the bulk. And as you'll see, here we have a vortex, a winding number 4 vortex in this simulation. And that vortex extends into a hole where there's zero condensate in the bulk. And in particular, it pierces through this slab. And then at the horizon, you see the rate, the color here is the rate of dissipation, of energy dissipation across the horizon. It's the energy flux across the horizon. So the first thing to say is that when you have a vortex, you've got a needle piercing the slab. And there's a hole controlled by the size of the vortex, which is basically the microscopic size in the system, the chemical potential, through which excitations can make it to the horizon. So this is a route for energy dissipation. Excitations bouncing around between the mirror and the boundary can find a hole and fall through and then hit the horizon and dissipate. Okay, so here let's watch this evolve. So here's the initial winding number four guy. It breaks up into its four individual vortices. Meanwhile, as that initial randomness relaxes away, the system comes to a more sort of calm, almost steady state. And then vortices find each other, annihilate. And as they do, notice that there's a big burst of radiation energy being dumped through the horizon. Boom, boom, all that energy is being dissipated. Okay. Just to quickly show that again, here's the energy being dissipated, and what you see here is big, glowing, dissipating spots. Those correspond to the vortices being dragged through the normal liquid, but here we have also the annihilation events, and at late time, all the energy deposition is coming from vortex annihilation. So here's the spectrum coming off that particular simulation. It has a nice k to the 5/3 scaling and then k to the minus 3 scaling, and that comes entirely from microphysics again. Here it can be calculated directly in terms of the microphysics of the vortex. So we know why we get this minus 3, and that's basically the dissipation scale. It's when stuff starts dumping down the vortex core. And here we see the Kolmogorov scaling. So now here's the question. The question is this a direct cascade or an inverse cascade? So we can answer that in a simple way. We can just, if we don't have any vortices present, we haven't been able to get anything that looks like a turbulent spectrum, a Kolmogorov spectrum. It seems, and this was expected by people in the superfluid community, that you really aren't going to get interesting turbulence in these systems without vortices present. That's a belief rather than a conclusion. Here we see effectively the same thing. Okay, so here, we look at the time average spectrum for two different simulations, and this is our first sign that we're seeing an inverse cascade. The reason is we have our initial deposition, and if it were an inverse cascade, the energy would be dumped into long distance, and eventually you'd get to the box size, and then you get coherent structures forming. If you double the box size, you should increase the range over which you have an inertial scaling regime. Here we've doubled the box size, and we get exactly the same cutoff. In fact, that cutoff is right where we have the lattice size of our system. So in fact, as we change the IR physics, we don't change the spectrum. That means we're not getting spectral flow out to the IR. But we can make that much sharper. So here's the sharper version of that statement. Here what I'm going to do is show you the energy spectrum as a function of time. So we're going to evolve this forward. For the system we've looked at previously, here's the scaling regime. Here's the -5/3. This isn't time averaged. But then this is actually two lines. It's representing two simulations with identical initial conditions. At a moment in time, shortly after the movie starts, we're going to kick the system in the IR. In the deep IR on box scale size, we're going to add energy into the system. We're going to watch the system evolve. We're going to watch the spectrum evolve and just see what happens. So here we kick it, and you see a huge deposition in the IR, and nothing is getting out here yet, but watch this energy transfer down the inertial regime, this -5/3 scaling. So just to play that again. So again, see the deposition, and you see it start making its way down the cascade. So I think those two bits of evidence together make a pretty compelling case that at least in this system, what we're seeing is a direct cascade in this two-dimensional superfluid. So to close off, I hope I've convinced you that black hole horizons, which are dual to turbulent flows, and again, for very special black holes, the black holes I'm studying which are in a box, about which ask me later, black holes can have fractal-like properties, and in particular scaling and a self-similar regime. And secondly, that turbulence in 2D superfluids drives energy into the UV, that it can be a direct cascade, not an inverse cascade. And that's a surprise to me, anyway. I didn't expect that. I think it's the first ab initio result in the literature on superfluid turbulence. So to close, I think it's really looking at the dynamics is a nice way to appreciate the power of this fluid gravity correspondence of holography, in that the fluid dynamics tell us a lot about the black hole physics. They really illuminate the black hole physics, I think, and vice versa in powerful ways, in ways that I think weren't anticipated. Ongoing work on this is studying these quasi-steady states by doing driving in a way that doesn't die. So I'm looking forward to discussing that more with you, please. And looking at non-zero net vorticity, which is a technical stupidity, but may have interesting physics once we do the simulations. There's an interesting story in the soliton physics in these systems, which is sort of counterintuitive. Normally when you have a field theory and you go to strong coupling, you expect the solitons to get light. Here, if you're looking at the hydrodynamics and you look at solitonic objects in the hydrodynamics, it's true that the underlying quantum field theory is strongly interacting, but you're in hydro and you're looking at solitonic objects within the hydro. And so it's a strong coupling, in some sense, it's a strong coupling QFT where you can still have heavy solitons. And there's an interesting sort of, there's an interesting story to tell there. The thing I'm really excited about, which papers should be forthcoming, is work on disorder, where we've been studying many body localization in these holographic systems. And again, it's a very similar idea. You're looking at systems that have no symmetries, no order, but you can still derive interesting consequences for the dual field theory. And there's a nice story to be told there, but it's a whole other talk. So I look forward to your questions.
Is your turbulent hydrodynamic event horizon?
Yes.
How does that affect the classical black hole event horizon?
It is the classical black hole event horizon. So when I say horizon, every time I say horizon, I mean the horizon of the black hole. I don't mean an effective acoustic horizon.
I really mean the horizon black hole. And what the way I think about this is that the horizon, the event horizon in the black hole, is the object that provides dissipation in the gravitational theory, mirroring or embodying the dissipation that we put in by hand in dissipative terms in hydro in the fluid description. So it's a nice way of taking a Lagrangian theory and allowing dissipation. If we're really lucky and God is good, then we will be able to take this holographic description that has a black hole and figure out a way to build a Lagrangian description of dissipative dynamics.
Nothing escapes this event horizon.
Expect
the fluctuations, the dissipation. There must be a leakage because you're fluctuating around the Schwarzschild mean.
It's guaranteed to only leak information into the black hole.
The question is, how does this relate to Hawking's recent famous
infamous, one might say.
I will mostly abstain, but I will make the following observation. I personally do not believe it has any bearing whatsoever to Hawking's paper. I don't think what I did has any bearing on Hawking's argument about an escape from firewalls in the absence of horizons. But that's probably at least in part because I don't understand the argument well. But on the cursory degree, I don't think.
The point is that classical Chia assumes space-time is C2 smooth at any length scale.
Yes.
But you're saying that's not the case.
No, I'm saying it is.
Everything in my expansion is perfectly smooth. There's nothing singular here.
There are no singularities.
There are absolutely no singularities outside the black hole or even at the horizon of the black holes I'm talking about. Everything is smooth. For my purposes, C2 smooth. In fact, in our simulations, the way the simulations work is by expanding all the unknown functions in a basis of analytic functions that all are C infinity, and then effectively studying the expansion coefficients, although we work in pseudo-spectral description. Yeah, so by construction, everything in this description was smooth. So I really don't have anything to say about the picture of singularities, about singularities at the horizon.
There are no shocks here. As time goes by, all these structures decaying quasi-normally down.
Yes.
So eventually you get back quiescent black hole.
There's nothing shocking here. You kick a black hole, it rings, right?
And that ringing dissipates, right? That's what we expect. I learned this from people when I was growing up. And what's changed here is two things. One, we put it in a box, and that changes the thermodynamics in an important way. And the second thing that's changed is that we're studying the system not just by kicking it, but by giving it spatially inhomogeneous excitations that could form interesting spatial structure, go into a turbulent flow. So those are the two things that are different, but they're very small differences from your intuition of just kick a black hole and it rings, and the ring fades. You throw a rock into a pond and it spreads in waves.
Just to continue a couple of minutes more. If you consider the surface as a fluctuating surface.
Yes.
You have noise. There's noise, and so it's dissipation. So you write down a Langevin equation a stochastic differential equation.
Okay.
The dissipation will affect the black hole horizon, the classical one. It has to.
Okay. Well, we're not.
So you're going to get a grain.
But we're not.
We're not introducing dissipation through Langevin dynamics. Everything is being. The dissipation is 100% from the causal dynamics of things falling across the event horizon. It's just quasi-normal mode dissipation of the black hole. There's no additional source of noise being introduced. I mean, technically there is because we're on a computer, but to the degree that we can crush that with a stick, we've crushed it with a stick. The dissipation is coming from causal, you know, time reversal breaking.
Maybe I should explain that. I put out a paper
perhaps
a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
This agrees with this.
I think I might have misunderstood something, because it seems like there's a real tension between the applicability of hydro, so the variation should be some very long scale.
Good.
On the other hand, concluding that the horizon, you know, is fractal and has structure at shorter and shorter scales. So
awesome.
Aren't I boxed into a corner somehow? Is it applicable, the conclusion?
That's an excellent question. So here, let me answer the question the following way. Oh, you probably guessed it. Let me do it on the other side. So, So here's my spectrum. Okay, and let's work in terms of k. In fact, let's work in terms of log k. Okay, let's look at the log of the energy density. Okay, so these are the plots I was drawing before, and we have a set of scales. We have a microscopic scale where dissipation is becoming important. Okay, so we know that beyond that thou shalt not go. This is going to regulate any sort of scaling, any sort of divergent scaling in the area, though.
So that's just microphysics. It's saying that at that point everything dissipates and there's no hydro, because if you drive it at shorter wave, at larger wave number, shorter length scales, those excitations dissipate immediately. So you have no right to talk about hydrodynamics. You certainly won't get Kolmogorov scaling, and the scaling will be ameliorated, regulated, and everything will be finite. Cool? So that's our UV microscopic scale. We then have an IR scale, which is box size. Okay? And then we have I'll say this is a IR box. And then we have the injection scale, which is the scale at which we've injected energy, or if we're doing quasi-equilibrium where we are continuously injecting energy. So let me call this k-inject. Okay? Now, what we expect to happen is to have a Kolmogorov scaling. The statement isn't that it does this. That would be an inverse cascade. The statement in these gravitational simulations is that we get a direct cascade. Sorry? Oh, sorry. It's not a direct. It doesn't go to the UV. Did I say inverse? Yeah. Okay. So it's not a direct cascade. It doesn't go to the UV. It goes to the IR. So it goes this way down, and then it turns over, and we get a regulation by the fact that we have a box. So this is no longer the story of the fluid. It's the story of the box, the coherent dynamics. The crucial thing is that it's true that we can't make the UV leg as large as we want, or as short distance as we want. But that doesn't matter. And more precisely, we can't make k injection arbitrarily high momentum. What we can do is make the box big. And so now the salient question isn't what's the injection scale. It's from the point of view of the size of the box, how many decades of scaling are you getting? And so the thing that controls hydro is, are you far enough away from the dissipation scale? So there's nothing inconsistent about making this domain as large as you like, because you're keeping yourself away from the dissipation scale. And all in this entire regime, the fluid gravity description, or more precisely the hydrodynamic expansion which can be implemented in fluid gravity, is reliable, precisely because our gradients are small compared to the injection cutoff scale, or the dissipation cutoff scale. What boxes us into a corner is if we have a box that's given by God, right? If there's some sort of built into the theory IR cutoff, yeah, then you get a finite domain of scaling. But you can get as many decades of scaling as you want if you just take the size of the box large. Computationally, that's of course expensive, you know. But
if you were doing this in global engineers, God wouldn't give you size.
Yeah. So you know, indeed. And so then there's an interesting story to be told between the lengths, the ADS length, and the size of the sphere, and the microphysical cutoff scale. But even there, it's still an interesting story. But you know, there's a box. Here, I was working in planar ADS to simplify my life and allow myself to take this as far as I want. And just technically, I was working with periodic boundary conditions on everything, so that's where the box came in. So there is a tension there, and you can feel that tension, but it doesn't kill you.
It just reminds you that you have to be going to the infrared, not to the UV. Now, if we had found that, in fact, the dynamics drove the energy density to the UV, then we really would have been, as it were, boxed in. But here we're not. Did that satisfy? OK, good. Something else, let me just quickly make one more point on this. There's a funny thing that happens in anytime you have a cascade, which is that, look, you've got this insanely nonlinear equation. All modes are coupled to all other modes. And yet, for some reason, energy is transported locally. What does that mean? Right? Well, effectively, what that means is that if you think about the kinematic triangle that constrains interactions, you know, you've got to conserve momentum, at least at leading order, you've got two long momenta and one short one corresponding to the momentum difference. So you've got to be dominated by exchange at some short momentum. And there's a nice holographic picture for this, which is that if you have, you know, fluctuations in the fluid velocity at some, you know, some distance and make it further apart or shorter, then that's controlled by GD's, that physics is controlled by the physics deep inside, corresponding to a rescaled or shortest or low energy excitation. So I don't know how to make that a precise statement, but it's a nice heuristic, which is sort of satisfying. Helps you understand why you get local dynamics. I'm thinking here, for those of you who are familiar with the fluid gravity story, I'm thinking specifically in the following sense. You have tubular neighborhoods in the fluid gravity picture, and those guys effectively interact through dynamics at the horizon. But those are IR modes. Those are IR exchanges, right? And then they get transported back up trivially, right? So that's this highly isosceles triangle that explains why you get local transfer of energy scale. And I think that's actually a really beautiful fact that we have that nice picture that comes out, because it's not at all obvious why this should ever be true if you just write down Navier-Stokes equation. You have to work hard to convince yourself that this is a sensible, consistent thing. And it really ends up being self-consistency, not derivation. So it's a qualitative picture I want to just inject into the system of physicists. Other questions?
For the superfluid, have you learned anything that goes beyond large N, or this is only for
so? Oh, no. This is all for some preposterous large N system. Now, you know, yeah, well, the way I think about it at the moment is that it's a proof in principle. It's a field theory where operator dimensions are strongly renormalized. It's strongly interacting in the microphysics. And you could just ask in that strongly interacting field theory, whatever else is true about it, what happens to its superfluid phase when you kick it in an inhomogeneous fashion? And you know, we know the answer now. Is that true for all theories? No, I mean, surely not. But the fact, so here's the thing I really want to take away from it. Right, I don't know. I surely not in the, you know, pessimistic meta-induction sense, right? So, you know, we're stupid as a species, so probably everything we think is wrong. And you know, everything we thought before, yada yada. But the thing I'd really like to take away from that story is that, first off, anyone who wants to tell you that superfluids have to have inverse cascades in 2D is probably wrong, right? I mean, they're wrong. But their intuition is probably suspect in some important way. And so that's a useful guide when you're wandering in the dark. If there's intuition that tells you something can't happen and it does, then you've learned something, right? So even not worrying about large N. But the second thing is, okay, true, this is holographically dual to some large N field theory, which technically speaking, we don't even know what field theory that is. But okay, fine, I'm going to define the field theory this way. It doesn't matter that it has some interpretation as large. I'm just going to define the field theory this way. And now, when you phrase it that way and you look at the correlation functions that come out of the theory, you look at the dynamics, they don't look weird. You know, they don't look like the sort of thing that's going to be dramatically spoiled by small quantum corrections or small 1 upon n corrections. So just on a knee-jerk level, I'd expect it to be fairly reliable. Those quantum corrections are going to tell us the most important thing of those from quantum corrections or 1 upon n corrections is going to come in at the level of the core of the vortices. Details of the vortex annihilation process. But the details weren't the important thing in the annihilation process. It was that there was a route to the annihilation where there was a nice big hole in the superfluid where stuff could fall down. And that's a fairly robust feature of the theory. If you add 1 upon n corrections, it's not going to dramatically change that fact. It's going to change details about exactly how that transport happens. So I think it suggests a stronger story than just the one particular example. But I'm only going to plant my flag in the one example.
Just a quick question. There were some very interesting dynamics from your simulation.
Yeah.
The vortex, the anti-vortex.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they come together, one moves in the flow field to the other, and they accelerate, and then they merge and create a pulse that goes forward. I mean, how much is known about that dynamic?
That's an excellent question. That's a really, really good question. Zero order,
nothing whatsoever. So in the existing superfluid literature, So let me just show you guys what was being referred to there. So watch pairs of vortices find each other. So I think these guys are going to, right? And then there's this big, complicated, beastly nonlinear wave. If you look inside, it's even more dramatic. So here's, so this settles down. And just look at the wave that comes out after the fact. And in particular, late in the simulation, two of these waves collide in a particularly clean way, which is nice. So where are we? Here we go. So there's a big wave coming through, but this is going to be nice and evident. You see there's a big wave coming out there. In a minute, two more of these annihilation events are going to, this from here and from here, are going to come together. And you'll see those waves pass right through each other. And it's really hard to do this by eye, but you can look and see if there's a phase shift, and there is. It looks like they're solitonic waves that passing through each other retain their shape after the interaction, but are phase shifted. And that's kind of cool. So there's probably some interesting, this is when I was talking about solitons, there's a lot of interesting soliton physics in this story. These sort of nonlinear waves live longer than you might expect, and they have some interesting scattering processes, interesting scattering physics that, to my knowledge, no one's ever studied. Part of the reason that you wouldn't have studied it before is it's very hard to actually do the damn calculations in a realistic field theory. And in a model where you're putting in an effective theory of the vortex dynamics, that's integrated out, right? That's been modeled into the details of the vortex scattering. So to my knowledge, this is an open book. And I think it's a really interesting open book. Very good question.